All right, without further ado, Dr. Prestera, you can just introduce yourself.
Can I have some more music again?
He has like too many degrees, titles, companies for me to keep straight.
It's just Gus Prestera, man about town. thank you all for coming today. I appreciate it, especially on such a lovely day, to take time away from swimming pools and backyard barbecues to come out. Appreciate it. For those of you who don't know, I have a couple companies, Effect Performance and Bevanauer Prestera & Associates, two training companies, focus on slightly different things. Effect Performance, customized training programs for companies where they own the subject matter, the expertise, and then the subject matter itself, and we come in and design and develop things for them. At Bevanauer Prestera & Associates, we actually develop our own subject matter, in areas of leadership, management, communications training, trainer certification, so forth. But both training companies, and then I also teach at Penn State Great Valley with Noel in the Instructional Systems Program, and I teach some of the e-learning design courses there, and then certified performance technologist through ISPI, and just somebody who enjoys training and instructional design. Not ashamed to be an instructional designer. and I've been doing this for, 10, 15 years now. And I've worked in as a training supervisor, as a trainer, as a stand-up trainer. I'm obviously not very good as a stand-up trainer, so I left that and took an office job as being a training supervisor. And then, hello there. We've got a small team back there in the corner. Then I left and I decided I wanted to get involved in the whole technology stuff, right? So I went to work for Allen Communication, big e-learning design company, back before we started calling it all e-learning. And so I got my feet wet there in the web-based training, computer-based training, simulation, and now mobile learning and all the new stuff that's coming out of the Web 2.0 technologies. And so over the years, I've enjoyed being able to mix and match different types of technologies and different types of different approaches and bringing that to different to solve different types of performance and learning problems. So I've always just had a natural affinity for blended learning. Were any of you here, I guess the last time I presented, I think it was at AACD, yeah, for blended learning? Yeah, so I've talked about it before. What's that? That was a Padlet? I'm sorry. I know it was at LaSalle. I couldn't remember. Yeah. Okay. So it was here. That was for Padlet. Yeah. So, so in the past, I've come in and I've talked about some of our experiences and some of the best practices we have for designing blended learning. Tonight, I'm going to review some of those a little bit. But we really wanted this to be interactive, hands-on. We want to give you a chance to work with each other, talk to each other, and not listen to me so much. So, we're going to do some group activities where you're going to design some blended learning. I'll give you kind of the subject matter and the objectives, and then kind of give you some general guidance, and then you guys will go off and do stuff, and we'll do it in rounds so that you'll do round one, and then we'll come back, we'll debrief, we'll talk about it, and then go to round two and round three. We survive. So let me give you a quick review of kind of how I approach blended learning. And I start with looking at learning and performance the process of learning as a process, and I try to look at it from the learner's perspective rather than from the designer's perspective, rather than looking at it just from the organization's perspective. So what does a learner go through when they want to learn something? So I want to learn anything. Pick a skill. Anybody?
Flying helicopters.
Flying helicopters. So if I suddenly get the urge, I'm curious about flying helicopters, and I talk to somebody, and they make me aware that you can actually go out and learn how to fly helicopters, these courses on how to do it. And not only that, but you might tell me how exciting it is and how it doesn't matter that you get motion sick very easily. Gosh, you're going to really love flying helicopters. It doesn't matter that you're not a very good driver. Flying a helicopter is 10 times easier after 10,000 hours of practice and so forth. So, but you get me really excited about it. And so I go through this awareness phase where I'm becoming aware that there's this thing out there that I might want to learn, and at some point, maybe or maybe not, I make this jump to going into this knowledge and skill building mode. I decide at some point, or somebody decides for me, that I need to actually learn this stuff. And so I start to acquire knowledge. How does this stuff work? And how does, you know, how the laws of physics work? And how does that relate to a helicopter? How, what all these different gears and levers? The universal control, all sorts of stuff. You have to use your feet and your hands. I know that it's not that easy. But anyway, so I practice and I do all kinds of stuff using a simulator, perhaps. And I practice. I isolate different skills as far as landing and taking off and flying and crashing and what have you. And at some point, I'm working with an instructor, and that instructor says, "Okay, you are blessed. You know how to fly this thing. Congratulations, you're certified. Now, would you get into the cockpit with me and let me take you for a ride at that point?" No, probably not. But if I really want to be able to do this, I need to transfer what I learned in the classroom with my instructor into going out and doing this solo. Right? And then solo, and then doing it with other people in the cockpit and so forth. I need to actually start doing it for real, not just in the training context. So there's this thing we all refer to as skill transfer, which is this huge leap that happens when we take something out of the classroom and we ask people to apply it in their work, in their real life, whatever. And then beyond that, over time, as I practice more and more and I get thousands of flight hours under my belt, I eventually will maybe become fluent in that skill. And anybody familiar with the term fluent and what that means in the instructional design realm? And those of you who attended the last one should know. Lynn? Fluent? What does it mean to be fluent in a language? In French. Just talking, right? Just chatting it up. You're not taking time to think about it. You're not looking it up in the dictionary, right? You're not looking it up on the web. It's fast. You're fast at it. You're not thinking consciously about it. You are thinking. Your brain is working. So you're just not necessarily putting a lot of effort into it. So it's kind of effortless. It's fluid. It's automatic. Right? So those are some of the terms that we associate with fluency. And not all things that we teach people do we expect them to ever become fluent in. Right? But if you want to teach me how to fly a helicopter, I'm actually going to be flying people around, and I'm going to get lots of practice at it. I hopefully will eventually become fluent at it. And then over time, of course, I may forget things. I may need refreshers. I may need somebody from time to time to remind me, "Hey, don't do that. That causes things to blow up. That releases all your gas. That's a bad thing." Right? So I may develop bad habits that may need to be corrected and so forth. But the real trouble spot for us is right here. If I can get past here, usually over time and with practice, I may develop skill fluency. But where we have the real obstacle is here, from going from skill mastery to skill transfer. A lot of times it doesn't happen. Troublingly, many, many times it doesn't happen for our learners. And it doesn't happen. The research tells us it doesn't happen. Managers tell us it doesn't happen. Learners tell us it doesn't happen. And why doesn't it happen? It happens because there's these barriers to transfer that happen. And so some of those barriers to transfer, why don't you tell me? Many of you are training professionals. What are some things that prevent your learners from taking what you've taught them and actually using them in the workplace? Yeah?
Lack of support from management.
Lack of management support. Yeah, that's a huge one. Yeah, Anthony? Yeah, maybe too much time goes by, and the memory decay, and they forget what you taught them. The sense of urgency to apply what you taught them has maybe dissipated. Yeah.
What about their motivation?
The motivation? Yeah, they may have never really been that excited about transferring this on the job. They maybe have said, "Oh, yeah, I'll go along with the knowledge and skill building, and I'll attend the classes, maybe because I have to," or so forth. But they maybe really never bought into the idea of actually changing their workplace behavior. Right. What else?
Reward system doesn't.
Rewards and lack of, yeah, the rewards, maybe the formal rewards, there's also the informal rewards, right? You mentioned the management support, but there's also your coworkers, right? You get back to the workplace and you say, "Hey, I learned this really cool thing in training. We've been doing this all wrong. We need to start doing this way, that way. And what happens with your coworkers, right? They get pushback. They throw stuff at you. They lock you in the closet. They start playing tricks on you. Yeah. So all sorts of things, some subtle, some not so subtle ways that your coworkers have of keeping you from making waves, right? So there's that. And there's lots more barriers to transfer. And one of the, wrong mouse. This is my really fancy illustration for what we're going to try to do about that. So any of you familiar with martial arts? You guys ever seen the person kicking through the block of cinder or punching through? Yeah. All right. What's it take in order to do that?
Concentration. Focus.
Concentration on what?
The target.
So hitting. So if I focus all of my energy on the front of that block, am I going to bust it up? Yeah. No. Why not? Follow through. Yeah. You have to aim for the back, and we typically aim for the front here. We aim to get people skill mastery. We want to get them to the point where, we can certify them, we bless them, and then we kick them out the door, and we hope that something good happens over here. And we're hopeful. But we don't really aim to change workplace behavior. And so when we do, and we actually focus our efforts back here on reaching and surpassing those expectations, maybe we've got a chance. At least that's the argument I make with my clients and with my instructional designers, with my colleagues, that we've at least got a chance. But if we're not even thinking about it, we're not shooting for it, we're not making every effort that we can to try to get past skill transfer, then we have no chance at all. And we give our learners very little chance. So this whole model is one way of explaining that there are two really important points in the process, in the learner's process, that I, as an instructional designer, really got to focus my attention on. These two tipping points, sorry to steal that from a book I read recently. Called tipping point. So there's two tipping points. One is that awareness building. If we can do something, well, whatever we can do, to try to get the learner to the point where they are excited or at least interested in learning, that they are committed to learning, that they've made some decision in their head, a conscious decision. Yes, I want to learn this. I want to get better at this. I want to fly a helicopter someday. I want to run a marathon. Right? Those words have to come out of their mouths, and they have to have a sense of commitment. And so, if we don't get that commitment, odds are they're not going to be able to get past that all those barriers that are out ahead of them. Oops, sorry. And then the second one, of course, is the one we've been talking about, the skill transfer one. Here, we have to do everything we can to try to get them over that tipping point of there. Sometimes you see the magic happen. Sometimes you see it in the classroom, and sometimes you see it when you're out in the workplace visiting, and you actually see change happening, performance change, behavioral change. People start to do things differently, and it's magical, and that's the thing, that's the high, I think, that keeps us all going, is every once in a while, we see that happen. We say, cool, isn't this cool? And it's not easy, but it occasionally happens. But that's where we need to focus our energy. So when I'm designing blended programs, I try to keep those two tipping points in mind. So let me just quickly run through the design process I use, and then I'll ask you to go to it. So I start by looking at the course, whatever it happens to be. Oftentimes we'll start off with an instructor-led course and try to convert it into a blended program. That's the norm. Sometimes it is a web-based course where it's all web-based. Somebody made the mistake a long time ago of firing all the trainers and saying, let's just move everything to computer-based training. And now they're having second thoughts and say, maybe we need something blended. But more often than not, it's an instructor-led course. So they say, I have a 5-day program, a 3-day program. We need to turn it into a blended program because maybe we don't have money. Maybe we don't have, we can't pull people out of their offices or cubes, out of the field. Or because they actually they're starting to believe that maybe blended learning, a blended approach, is a more effective way to teach people. Whatever the reason, I'm just happy that they want to do it. But I start with trying to match the technologies and the approaches. And there's so many different technologies, so many different instructional design approaches. that that it can be mind-boggling. So I start with some of the basics. So I ask myself, what can be, what currently is maybe instructor-led or facilitated that could be done self-paced? What could people do on their own? Versus where do they really need the instructor to help them? The other place is, you know, what are some things that are currently face-to-face that really don't need to be face-to-face, that could be done online? Maybe it could be done as effectively or maybe even better online. And then how can I make sure I strike a balance between the effective, you know, having an effective course, an efficient course, and containing costs? So I look at those three things. Then I start to optimize. So then that helps you flesh out some basic blend, and I'll show you an example in a sec. Then I begin to think about, okay, how do I optimize these different parts? So we said that those two tipping points, right, that happen at the awareness into knowledge and skill building, and from mastery into transfer. So really, what can I do now to optimize what I'm doing for those key points? What can I do to get commitment? What can I do to promote transfer? And then the other area where I want to optimize is in the classroom training. If we're going to keep any classroom training or any face-to-face training or anything like that, I want to treat it like it's a precious commodity. Because in today's world, it really is becoming more and more precious, this time that we actually have face-to-face with learners. So we need to respect that. And too often, we're doing things in the classroom that we really don't need to be doing and wasting a lot of time. And that's been the case for many years. But I want to see what can I do to really take advantage of the fact that I've got a bunch of people there. I've got an instructor who's highly qualified and has a lot in their head, a lot of experience, a lot of expertise. I've got a room full of people, and I've got the immediacy of everybody being together in one place at one time, and the potential intimacy that can create. So that gives me opportunities to do a lot of stuff with feedback, modeling, and discussion. And then how can I maximize the amount of hands-on practice that I'm doing? And then the fourth thing that I think about, cohesion. How do I keep this whole thing? One of the dangers with blended learning is that you send people out to do all these different things, you lose control of them, and they kind of lose focus, and they start to drift. You send them off, hey, go read this. Go take this online course over there. Go take this online test over here. Here's a mobile learning module. Take some of that. Hey, here's a podcast. Take some of that. Some people are very good at managing all that complexity, but a lot of them are not. So we need to help them. So what can I do to guide them through that process? And how can I make sure that there's enough overlap there so that they can see the connections, but not so much overlap that there's a lot of redundancy? Right? And that with a lot of redundancy, they get bored, disengaged, you waste time, money, effort, so forth. So redundancy back. And then the last thing I think about is, how can I give it legs? How can I make sure that we keep this in front of people as they're out there trying to work this into their day-to-day work patterns, as perhaps they're trying to build fluency over time? How can I make sure I stay engaged with them, or I keep the content engaged with them over time? So I'm doing things to promote fluency, and I'm doing things to prevent fading. Right, where people forget what they learned in the classroom. So that's the basic process I go through. And let me show you an example of that. Those of you who were here last time saw me do this. I took a coaching course, 3-day coaching course, that was all classroom, 3 days of straight classroom stuff. Lots of practice, lots of lecture, lots of discussion, lots of good stuff. It was a very good 3-day course. But we had to make it a blended program. So we started with that first step, which was, seeing what can we take out of the classroom that didn't need to be face-to-face, that could be done online? What could we make self-paced that didn't need to be facilitated? And so we started with taking out the introductory stuff that happens at the beginning of the course, where we waste an hour or two, sometimes more, at the beginning of every program, giving people an overview, trying to establish relevancy, generate interest. We do all this stuff right at the beginning of every program. And some of that's useful and is worth keeping, but some of that we felt we could take out and move into a webinar at the very beginning of the program. And then there's a lot of knowledge content where we have the presenter lecturing and presenting stuff, doing what I'm doing now. If we were smart, we could take what I'm doing now and create some web-based training around it and throw it up there for everybody to attend. And then when you all walked in here, you could have all gotten all this junk and we could have gotten right to the hands-on stuff. So we have two web-based tutorials that take care of a lot of the knowledge content. What are the best practices around coaching? What do you think? What kinds of things do you need to do to lay the groundwork and set up the relationship with the people you're going to coach? Establish some mutual understanding of what their expectations are, what your expectations are. That way you can get started with your coaching. And then the second course is, once you get started with your coaching, what does that coaching interaction look like? Best practices, things to do, don't do, that sort of stuff. Then the online test, covering the knowledge content. So I'm assessing mastery of this content. All right, so I've done what I can now to streamline the course, and I've been able to take that 3-day classroom course and turn it into about a day and a half of classroom course. And a day and a half has really been taken and moved up online and made self-paced or in webinar. So now I'm thinking about how can I optimize those two key points of gaining commitment and promoting transfer. So one of the things we wanted to do was have a half-day program, up to a half-day program, might have to be less depending on the organization, but have a half-day program where we can meet with the managers of the people we're going to be teaching how to coach. Because we want them to be good role models. We need to get management support, know that. Right? We need their help in establishing an environment where transfer can take place, where people aren't going to be calling our trainees names, bad names, for trying to be good coaches. Right? So to talk to them about creating incentives and rewards. Right? So doing all that kind of stuff. So we need to engage with those managers. So we wanted to do that even before we start the training. And also give those managers some input into the design of the program. So what kinds of issues you as a manager are you concerned about with regards to your employees and how they coach their people? How would you like to see them coach better and more effectively? Right? So we give them some buy-in into the whole program. So that's an important piece. Then we have these on-the-job assignments. So not everything has to happen in the classroom or online. Some things can happen offline. So after they do this webinar, they complete a survey offline. Before they come into the classroom, they do an assignment where they actually go out and have a meeting with one of the people they're going to coach, and do the laying the groundwork kind of stuff, and do that before they come to class, so that when they come to class, we can debrief. How did that go? What worked well? What didn't work well? So forth. And then after the classroom event, they have another assignment where they go off now and start actually having coaching conversations with people. Because in the classroom, you spend a day and a half, where 80% of it, maybe more, is actually practicing how to coach. Right? Through role plays and that sort of thing. So then of course, you give them this assignment to go off and do after the class, and most of the time that doesn't happen, right? When we do it now. Say after, so next steps, go off and do this assignment. But you're never going to see them again, and they're never going to see you, so odds are they're probably not going to do it. So we have a follow-up conference call, or a webinar, where we bring them back together a couple weeks later, and we talk about how it went and didn't go. And if they didn't do it, that goes back to the managers we engaged back up here. Right? If they're running into obstacles and challenges where they're not getting the support that they need, we loop that information back to the managers. And these are things that we're doing because we're not aiming for skill mastery, we're aiming for skill transfer and beyond. Then to help keep it all cohesive, we have a playbook, and I'll pass that around. This is a sample one. And the playbook is, a workbook, but it is a workbook that ties together the whole course map. It starts with the introductory webinar and all the stuff that's happening there, and takes them all the way through to the end. So it is their anchor for the whole program. Like I said before, it's very easy for them to get lost. And then I think about how to give it legs. How do I give this legs? One of the ways is through a series of podcasts where we could send them a monthly podcast where we remind them of some of the stuff that they learned in the classroom and maybe take that and apply it to different situations. So different types of coaching situations. And those different types of coaching situations, where did they come from? They came from the managers, and they came from the discussion with the actual target learners. You know, what are some of the coaching challenges they have? And then we try to reflect those in the podcast series that we send out. And then the other way that we try to keep them engaged over time is through a resource site, which we're talking about turning into a community site, where kind of like with the blog, where we can put up information, but we can also have them put up information, share best practices with each other, share their questions and concerns and challenges and how they're handling those, and share resources, tips, job aids, what have you. So those are a couple of ways that we're trying to give it legs. We could probably think of lots more ways. And so here's what we wound up with. So we could have a 3-day classroom course with some pre-work and post-work that we know that they're not going to do. And then we can still give them access to this resource site, which they probably won't take advantage of. Or we can have this kind of a program where we have an introductory webinar. We've got some FaceTime with them that's live, even though it's online. We've got some web-based training that they're doing on their own to get the knowledge. We're having a knowledge check there. They have a pre-work assignment that we follow up with in class. Lots and lots of practice, hands-on practice here. Post-work assignment that we follow up in another webinar. And then now, we've established, I think, some good habits and some enough learner engagement that maybe we've got a chance to follow up with them with the resource site and the podcast over time and try to keep them engaged in all that. And in the background, behind all that, we've engaged the managers to try to set the right tone, the right environment, the right reward system in place to promote transfer. So it's a different way of looking at blended learning than just saying, oh, let's create an online course and smack it together with an instructor-led course. A little bit different than just saying, hey, let's take this book and move it online and have them read that before they come to class. It takes a little bit more thought. It can cost more money, but it doesn't necessarily have to, because some of these things are things that you may already have in place. You may already have a mechanism for doing webinars. You already have conference calling systems. Would you have Centra or WebEx or Adobe Connect? What is it? iLink? Of course, iLink. Your organization may already have these in place, and you may already have instructors who are doing classroom stuff. So now it's shifting some of that time that they would have spent in a classroom and moving it online. There's a learning curve, of course. It's more complicated to manage something like this than it is to manage something like this. But is it worth it? I think so. Anyway, so that's, before I move on, any questions about the process I just outlined? Yes?
Yeah, I got a lot of ways to overcome some of the challenges, either scenario one or two. You have the management involvement, you know, just sales managers, or was it just general, you know, manager and their direct report that people were being coached?
This is, this course is not necessarily for a particular audience, but we're talking about the managers of the managers. So you've got maybe this first line supervisors that you want to train on how to coach. We're trying to engage the level above them, whoever those people are.
Okay, because I've done many courses. Obviously, you don't have everyone who does the pre-work, and you have to, you know, review the material in the live session, you know, the 3-day live.
Yeah.
That's critical that there's more time put on before the program that people are going to be doing the work in advance, otherwise it slows down that day and a half.
Yes, it's absolutely critical. So with this kind of an approach, and really anytime you're seriously doing any pre-work, and seriously because, you know, sometimes we just give people stuff to read and we don't really expect them to read it. It'd be nice if some of them did. That's very different from serious pre-work where you really want them to do something and learn on their own and come with ideas and experiences into the classroom. That's always going to be a challenge, just try to get them to do that. When you engage with their managers, you have a better chance of that. You know, through your LMS, you can generate reports and feed that back to the managers. You can also, you know, one of the things that we do with the introductory webinar, we built into that, is this idea of a learning contract that, you know, we lay out for them. Here's what we've done. We could have given you a three-day course. Instead, we're only taking you out of the office for a day and a half. But in order to make that work, and for you to get the same value out of all this, here's what you're going to need to do on your end. Can you commit to that? Tell us now. Yes or no. If you can't, let's not all waste time. But if you can, let's do it. And we'll give you the tools to make it happen. And we say the same thing to the managers. You know, if you don't really feel like you can drive this, let's not bother. Let's just bring them into the classroom and just do our thing, and let's pretend like we did something effective and have them go off and not do anything differently. But if you're serious about trying to effect some change, we need your help. We need your participation, cooperation. And that's critical. Yeah?
What are, on your learning process chart, skill transfer, what are three or four things you can do to design into the program for that? I see on the
promote practice, transfer? Yeah.
I guess practice in the classroom assignment.
Yep. And realistic class. Yeah. I mean, we contextualize that practice as not just practicing generic stuff. It's practicing situations that are very relevant to that audience. And so that requires a little bit of upfront work and talking to people who are in that audience and finding out what their issues are, what their common challenges are, talking to their managers, of course. And so we gather that and we build into this program placeholders where we've got places where cases, scenarios, mini cases, examples that are highly relevant that come from that audience. Right? So that's one of the things that we try to do to make sure that the practice they get is as authentic and meaningful as possible. The other thing that we try to do is we try to anticipate some of the challenges that they have. So we try to feed the, when we have the follow-up in the classroom and the follow-up in the webinar stuff, we try to feed that back into the program. So the challenges that people are coming across, if there are things that we can do something about in training, we do. We loop that back in into the scenarios that we're addressing, into some of the discussion that we're having. So what's going to happen, Charlie, tomorrow when you get back to the office and you tell everybody, or you start telling your employees that this is how you want to start coaching them? What's some pushback that you're going to get from them? And then you try to tackle some of that stuff in the classroom, right? A lot of times we sort of pretend like when they get out there, everybody's going to be really excited about change, but it doesn't happen. So we have to change. We have to treat them all like they're change managers, right? And so we try to build some change management training into all the training that we do across all programs, because any real learning involves change, and change is painful. So that's another thing. The reaching out to management is a really critical one, because management holds a lot of the levers that control performance, right? They control incentives, rewards. They help drive the culture, the norms. They kind of set expectations as to, you know, what is good performance and what's bad performance, right? So if we can't get to them and hear from them what they need, and they can't hear from their people what their people are feeling, then we're in trouble. And so we try to create some dialogue. And this process helps to do some of that. So before we even do that introductory webinar, we've done some front-end analysis where we're talking to all the different stakeholders. We do the introductory webinar, with the executive briefing with the managers. We loop what comes out of that meeting into this introductory webinar. Here's what your managers are telling us that you need. Right? And then, of course, they're going to have some thoughts. So we loop that back to the managers. And so we try to be the catalyst for having this conversation going back and forth between management and the people that are being trained.
Change often starts at the top. Is it only a half day with the managers enough to affect change at that level?
No. Well, in some cases, yes. But what we try to do is, before even we get into the training, as part of the front-end analysis, we're trying to engage as many stakeholders as possible. And so we work with, in sales, for example, we've worked with the national directors who are in charge of all the regional directors, who are in charge of all the district directors, who are in charge of all the sales managers, who are in charge of all the territory managers, right? So we're working 5, 6, 7 levels up, and then working our way through that whole hierarchy.
Corporate culture is very difficult.
Yeah. And then the other thing we try to do, and so one of the things that we try to do also is is bring it down to that small, that department level. You know, so if we can work with a group, a department, a territory, a district, one district at a time, we've got a better chance because the levers of control are more tightly held.
That's a more mini culture.
Yeah, it's a mini culture. A little easier to manage and change a bit.
Mm-hmm. And this process that you just described might be the only glimpse those senior people are seeing of the granular things that are going on at the front lines. Otherwise, it's filtered and filtered and filtered to look nice before it gets to their level. This drives it right on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the neat things I find about training. It's always given me an opportunity to make those connections for management. You know, even when we go in and work with subject matter experts and their bosses and so forth, they have this idea in their head, and you know, we come at them with, okay, well, we've done some surveying of your target learners. Here's what they're saying. We've gone out and done some observation. We've spent some time with people in the field. We've interviewed folks. Here's what they're saying. And so we're sort of the voice of the consumer for them. And conversely, a lot of times are feeding information back out to the field for them. But I think it's even more valuable when we're able to bring that feedback to them.
One of the things that this struck me is managers love it when you do something in a day and a half as opposed to taking your people away for 3 days. However, what I think they will see, and perhaps you can talk about this, is they'll see, oh, it's only 1.5 days. Great. I don't think they see a time component e-learning and the other things that you're asking them to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's very tempting and sometimes very hard, either for the supervisor or the manager, to quote, give them the time to do the things that you don't put time on. Do you know what I mean?
So we put time on that.
That you have to, to me that it might be beneficial to do that so that they know a 1.5 classroom and e-learning and OJT. That also has time constraints.
That's right. Yeah, and so in the playbook that's going around, in the schedule, we actually put time to all of these things. So it's not just your 10-day and a half. You know, this is going to take you half an hour, and this one's going to take you half an hour,
so
this will take you an hour.
Sorry,
and this,
I didn't see that before. So, pardon me for interrupting you. So how many hours is it? So the 3-day class, does it become a 3-day? When you time that out, what time?
Not including these. You could, but this is obvious. The 12, and they're like 3 minutes each.
Okay.
But really, so the main part, but you know, from beginning to graduation, I think you may be saving 2 or 3 hours of actual time, assuming that you're pretending that people are doing these things. If you eliminated these,
we don't put time on the 3-day class. We don't necessarily put time on the 3-work week. You see, so it's when we compare, we really have to make sure we're comparing the same to the same.
And the learners see that and are more concerned about that. You're right, than the managers. The managers are like, great, day and a half. But you know, the case that we try to make for them is that in order for to do it a day and a half and for it to be as effective as your current 3-day program, or more effective, here's what's involved. And it's not just the learner's time, but it's also the manager's involvement that's really going to drive the success of this. And of course, that's true for both of these programs. But we need it even more here because there's the learners out on their own for a lot of this, right? We're asking the learners to do a lot of things on their own, so they need more support, especially the first few times, you know, because this is a somewhat new thing for learners. You're giving me pre-work and you actually expect me to do it? That's new. It's different. So
and one last question. Mm-hmm. Do you have a in terms of how much time between a classroom event before you get the blue? How much time?
Yeah, we haven't recommended that,
but
it's really up to the client. But you know, we might do the executive briefing and the introductory webinar in the same week, one early in the week, one later in the week, and then we might give them a week to do both. Because we're really talking like half an hour for each, even it's like 20 minutes for each, but let's say you give them half an hour for each, 15, 20 minutes for this. So you might do this on the this and the pre-work in the third week. In the fourth week you're here. Ideally, you'd want to give them a couple weeks to do this, and go out on, you know, come back with some experiences.
So what happens with the forgetful factor, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to monopolize the question, but okay. I just have somebody coming in, you know.
Yeah, no, that's great. So
in terms of people forgetting or being, you know, okay, I learned that a week ago, but I really forgot it because I've done 12 other things.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. That happens. So the playbook is partially there to help them with that, so that's their anchor. Then the other thing that is anchoring them to the program is the LMS, and the administrative support behind it. So what we like to do is host it ourselves and provide that support ourselves, because you know our instructor will reach out to people and remind them of things. Right? Our instructor, after they've already met with them here, can reach out with and check in on how they're doing with their online coursework. And we can see on our side, we can see through the LMS reports who's doing it, who's not doing it, who's started it, who hasn't started it. It's easier for us to do it. For them, for our clients, they have to go through their LMS administrator to get a report, and the report's usually very nasty looking, and if they can get the right information in a timely fashion, and then once they get it, what am I going to do? I got to call all these people or send them emails? It's a real hassle. So, but our instructors are already engaged in talking to these people, so it's easier for our instructor to just be that person that's checking in on them. The LMS can also send out automatic reminders, so if they haven't completed these courses in a certain amount of time, whatever you set as the completion date, it will send reminders out, and you can say, you know, send the reminder out a day before or 2 days before that day, the day of, the day later, and remind them every 15 minutes, however intrusive you choose to be about it. And then same with the assignments, through our LMS we can post assignments on our LMS and have them actually complete the assignments in the LMS. So if we ask you to go off and meet with somebody, meet with one of your employees, there would be some sort of a debrief that you come back and you go online and you type in maybe a little transcript or a reflection of what happened, how did that meeting go. And then that automatically gets submitted to or emailed to the instructor. Now the instructor's got it as they come into the classroom. They've already interacted with the audience online. They've established some rapport. And they're seeing kind of where each individual is in the process. So, but that it's not easy for big companies to do that with their LMSs, because their LMSs are so big. Oftentimes, the training departments are very detached from their LMS. They've got IT between them and their LMS, or their LMS administrator. So their LMS isn't providing what I call tactical support. Their LMS is this huge thing that's carrying a lot of courses, and they do a lot of big things with it. But the little things that you need done every day to day can get harder to do in a big organization. So that's why we like to do it ourselves. But if a client wants, they can host it on their course, on their LMS. But we still need the reporting. We need access to the reports in a timely fashion and so forth, which can be a challenge. So yeah, there needs to be follow-up. But of course, they need to have follow-up regardless. You're going to need more of it in a process like this than you are in a three-day course, I think. Yeah.
For LMS, just the acronym Learning Management System?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Learning Management System. Yep.
For those of us that have never experienced Learning Management System, it's an interesting concept. What is the feedback loop that's built into the system to say this person is somebody that will never get through that barrier?
The transfer barrier?
Yeah.
Yeah. We have these debriefs with them, so we get a sense from them one-on-one as to how they're doing and who's struggling, who's not struggling. And then the instructor is ultimately that person who's going to make or break that, right? They're going to be the ones who are going to take the time offline and say, hey, let's you and I chat a little bit. I'm sensing like you're struggling with some of this stuff. And they're going to give them that extra time, just like in a three-day classroom course. If you have a good instructor, they're going to work with individuals one-on-one, whether it's online or offline or combination, and try to make it happen. Some people are just never going to have it
happen. Is that supported by senior management? It sounds to me like basically senior management takes a look at this and says, how detached can I possibly be from this system? Because I have to just plug people through the system.
If the reason for the lack of transfer is management, then it's not really about the instructor working one-on-one with the employee. And so that's where that feedback loop comes in, with the instructors collecting feedback from the audience, and then we send that back to the managers who we've met with, who also committed to helping us. Now, if they don't do their part, we got to remind them of that. It's like, you said you were going to do this, but here's the feedback we're getting from people in the field. Now, if you've got bad management, what can you do?
Well, let's contextualize.
You can't go very far.
What is the percentage of management that you've experienced that you really don't see, or basically see what I'd like to call the 100-mile stare when you're telling them as to how things are working?
The ones who don't get it, for me, I think a little cynical. I'd say 1 in 3.
All right, so you're 33%.
Yeah.
That's actually better than I would expect.
Yeah, I'm a little cynical that way. Yeah, okay. I would if I were in there, I'd fire them. Yeah, I don't have that choice, of course. But I still got to work with that 1 in 3. I still got to try to influence. And sometimes you can turn them. Sometimes you can't. And the other things that I do as a consultant is I work with my clients on other initiatives, like, for example, Management Assessment Center, which we talk about in another session, where I help them develop programs where they can assess the capabilities of their managers before they invest the time in training their managers to try to avoid some of those blank stares, right? The folks who don't get it. But yeah, if you don't have good managers, then you're SOL, right? The good training isn't going to make a difference, at least not with the 1 in 3.
Does anyone else here see a difference in teaching a new skill as opposed to changing ingrained behaviors, with training? I mean, I feel I do. I think it's easier to teach a new skill that's immediately going to be seized on as a tool, something useful, something to help me get something done, versus changing me, changing my belief structure, changing my behaviors, changing my outcomes. That's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'd agree with that.
As
I think to the extent
people having an evangelical moment,
yeah,
maybe in the classroom, but then over a period of weeks, just falling away and falling back to those.
Yeah. Yeah. And any of you watch The Biggest Loser?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We can't all hope to have that level of influence as trainers on our folks, but it is inspiring. Like,
yeah,
when I see them, I'm like, wow, look at the, you know, that's the power of a trainer, a really great trainer who can motivate, who can give people a clear path to success. And there you are. You're asking them to make a life change. In a lot of cases, we're not asking them to do that. We're asking them to become a better coach, treat their people a little bit better than they have in the past, communicate a little bit more clearly than they have in the past. We're not asking them to change who they are. A lot of times, we're asking them to change their behaviors.
Actually, you kind of are.
You are asking.
That's where I have my problem. Mm-hmm. Back there, what you're talking about.
The belief system change. You don't change your behavior.
Well, it's not even the belief system. I believe in the cognitive theory that we're all wired differently between the ages of 3 and 13.
Uh-huh.
So the bottom line is, I loved it. When I worked for a major corporation, if you had somebody that would have screaming arguments with people in the hallways, we'd, of course, send them to conflict management. And then 2 weeks later, they'd be right back to baseline. And it's like, how can you as a trainer, now turn to this person and say, it's clear you don't have the wiring to, go into a team situation. I mean, trainer, corporation, the bottom line is good that you're coming. I've just seen so many people try to train folks that do not have the wiring to do this. The other classic one that I love, public speaking. Trying to train somebody to be a great public speaker. And for someone that would rather be dead than in front of a group of people,
yeah,
is absurd.
That's me. I'd rather be dead.
You know what?
Thank you.
That's because you're cognitive. If you're a behaviorist, you say, of course you can do that.
So there are specific skills. And I understand exactly what you're saying. But there are skills that would improve public speaking. And I believe that people can be taught ways to do it. They may not be great, but they can say, the first thing I have to say is what I'm going to say. Okay, I'm going to build a sentence or two around that. So I think there are specific behaviors they can learn and practice, and a lot of practice. I also think in terms of coaching, there are specific behaviors that you can, now you may feel like a phony baloney in the beginning, just like many of us feel incompetent when we're trying to learn something new. But I think as trainers, regardless of whether we're blending or classroom, you really have to focus on behaviors. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to teach you 3 steps. It's not going to make you great, okay? But when someone does something that's incorrect, instead of yelling, try to do this.
But I look at it from a different perspective. I look at it and say, okay, as trainers, aren't we also coaches? And the bottom line is you have to get to the point where you say, guess what? You know what? I can train you 40 days straight on how to be a great presenter. The truth is you should never be a presenter. You know, the truth is you should not be a leader of this organization. You should be a worker. You know, where do we become coaches versus trainers? Because the truth is we waste our time and companies' valuable dollars to go ahead and sit there and try to turn to somebody and say, I'm going to make you into a great VP when this person couldn't lead their way in a white paper bag. So that's my question.
But, I mean, I think we can start getting into a philosophical difference here that it's a little bit outside the scope of our blended learning strategy. And I'd like to just maybe just bring it back to, because I would like to have you guys spend some time working on doing a blend of your own, designing a blend, and maybe tackling some of these issues that you're talking about, some of the questions that you're raising, seeing if that's something you can work into your blend. And it's interesting enough that you talk about public speaking, because that's the content that we're working with here. So if you flip your handout around, this is an outline of objectives for a presentation skills course. Sounds oddly enough. So there are three sets of objectives. The course is built around the idea of helping people design more effective presentation, to build it, to build all the materials for it, and then deliver it. So if you want to think of it as three courses, if you want, or three modules within a course, regardless. So it's a course with those three overarching objectives, and then within that, you've got these more granular objectives. So what I'd like you to do is, in this first round, go through, first of all, one of you in the group, I need you to volunteer your audience. So a group within your organization who you think could benefit from presentation skills training, probably everybody, right? But pick a specific audience, a specific level, position, and then describe that to your group members, ask some questions of that person, try to understand a little bit more about them, who they are, what they do, some of the technology that they worked with in the past and so forth. Just get a general understanding of who these people are. And then start to tackle this first set of issues, which is what if assuming this is all a classroom program, what are some things that you could do to design a program that took some of that, moved it online, took some of that stuff that's facilitated, made it self-paced? And what might that blend look like for you? Right, so we'll do that in this first round, and then we'll give you about 5 minutes? Six and a half minutes to do that, and then we'll stop, we'll talk about that, and then we'll see if we've got time for the other rounds.
All right.
So step one, matching the technologies and approaches with the needs. So why don't we start, we go around the room, and we get to describe the audience, just one or two sentences about the audience, and what are some things that you might be able to move online? What are some things that you may be able to make self-paced? Who wants to start? A brave group?
Well,
all right.
We can start.
Yep, there you go.
One thing
Who's
we
your audience?
On, was a scientist making a presentation.
Scientist making
okay.
presentations. Like chemists?
Chemists, engineers.
Okay. So we're teaching scientists how to make presentations.
Right.
Okay.
And the thing that we agreed upon, we had a lot of discussion. The next 6 minutes, I'm assuming, will be the most productive of our table. But we decided that point number three was classroom, and points number one and two would be somehow either self-paced or online.
Okay. So you agree that all of the design related objectives there, and all of the development related objectives, that you could accomplish all those online, but that all of the delivery skills needed to be done in the classroom.
Actually, I think one of the things we were probably about to get to was it's kind of a hybrid model. Huh. We believe that a lot of the basics can be done online, but then there actually has to be connective coordination and coaching. to go ahead and make sure that they can implement this in a way that's going to attract the attention of the sea levels they're presenting to.
Okay. All right, great. And did you get past that at all? Talk about specific technologies yet?
No.
Okay. All right. Who wants to go next? Yeah, Anthony?
We chose our audience to be salespeople. Three needs that we, first need that we identify for salespeople would be a need for flexibility and technology or approaches that we choose to address flexibility would be learning podcasts, those learning video and tabs and webinars.
Okay.
The second need for salespeople would be practice and application for skills. The approaches for technology would be role playing, video tape, and presentation.
Can you map that back to us to some of the objectives?
Yeah.
But, in the next 6 minutes. Okay. did you talk about, are there certain things that you would use some of those technologies for in particular?
Well, I think for practice and application for like role playing and video that certainly address the delivery or the
who's following up, or what? How's the follow-up happening?
Sorry?
How's the follow-up happening?
Well, we provide the learners with a self-evaluation checklist that they can use periodically. They can label it for all three of these.
Brown noser. Yeah. All right, great. Carol?
Clarifying question. Hmm? What's mobile learning?
Mobile learning? Learning that's done through your PDA, mobile computing device.
Oh, all right. So would you consider a podcast mobile learning or no? That's
it could be, yeah.
All right. Yeah. If people using saying podcast mobile learning, I was like, Are they the same? Are they different? Okay.
Yeah. A podcast you can view from your computer
or
you can view from a mobile device. Yeah. So it kind of depends on how you're using it. Yeah. All right. Would you like your group to go next?
Me.
We're all looking at you.
Whose
audience is this?
Senior managers.
Senior managers? Okay. Like VPs?
Yeah, some more VPs.
Senior directors.
Senior directors and VPs right in there. Okay.
Sorry.
What'd you come up with so far?
It's kind of the same.
Yeah, we're kind of the same as the first table over here said. I mean, we pretty much agreed that most all this really can be done through e-learning.
One and two.
But even parts of three can, as far as the information. But of course, the application piece would be in a face-to-face classroom where they were actually then taking all the content that they've learned and now applying it.
Gotcha.
That's mainly how we put it. As far as the technology, I mean, podcasts definitely, webinars, but interactive webinars. I like the simulations. Post assessments.
Where would you use simulations here?
Show them the examples, for instance, of the slides. Show them examples of, for instance, here, managing your nonverbal communications, interacting with the audience, giving them a good versus a bad.
So the simulations would be used to demonstrate.
Right. Yeah. As far as they're getting the content in their e-learning, then of course all that would be applied in the classroom because all the classroom should be is actually conducting the presentation. Of course, you're going to revisit what they've learned, and then everything should be done through mock presentations, videotaping them, and then they can play back what they've done.
Gotcha. And is there, if you only had time to do, to focus on one thing in the classroom, what would it be?
The live presentation and feedback.
Yeah, having them present
and
giving them coaching and feedback
right.
on it, right? So if you had to... Could you? Sorry, go ahead.
Bring it together at the beginning
lot of this other stuff once you've gotten them excited about getting into it, and then bring them back for that presentation, conclusion, feedback.
Yeah, because what's the benefit of the group? What? How can the group help us here?
Well, it's an audience.
Well, it's an audience. That's true. Yeah, so they can act as an audience for one another. You mentioned before that some people are a little skittish about presenting, right? Could you see maybe that audience acting as a support network?
Because they know them.
Yeah. Hopefully.
You know, I have to say that Dale Carnegie does that kind of thing really well. You know, if anyone else has partaken of that, because they will get people up there and presenting and have no intention ever doing that before, and the group becomes extremely supportive of those individuals.
Yeah, they're all in the same boat.
It's a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah, they're all in the same boat, right? And that's the case with a lot of our learners, that they're all in the same boat.
Some
they're all struggling with the same issues.
But
yeah, some have been sentenced to being there in the presentation skills class. A lot of times, the folks who are there for a reason. You might send everybody to it, but a lot of times you send the people who you think need it. And so they're all in a similar position where they needed to advance into organizations, and yet they don't think themselves particularly good at it. They don't have a lot of confidence. So one of the ways in which we could use technologies is to create an online community of practitioners here who can support one another, right? Where you can have Bill Gates talking about how, you know, when he started presenting, he was really bad at it and he sucked at it, but he realized that, you know, he's the CEO of this big company. People expect him to do press conferences and stand up in front of people and talk about stuff. And so he took your course, and look at him now. And so forth. But then, you know, wouldn't it be nice to be able to interact with Bill in some way, right? We obviously aren't going to be able to sit face-to-face with Bill. Probably not. But maybe we can, through online communities, maybe we can get a piece of Bill. You know, a piece of Bill's experiences. And you can do the same with other people, right, who've been through the program or who've been through similar programs and establish some sort of a community of practitioners. And through synchronous and asynchronous communication, through blogs, through...
That kind of presentation is new for a lot of people. Some of your presentations I've done at some trains, and then it came time to webcast.
It's a whole new thing, right?
I won't be able to get all the clues I need, you know.
So there's, you know, we're thinking in terms of just these skills, right? But there's more to it than just the skills. If we're thinking about transfer and how are we actually going to get this presenter to get to the point where he or she can stand up in front of him and deliver a decent presentation, at least. Maybe they'll never be great, right? But at least good. And at least feel somewhat comfortable so that they're not wetting their pants when they're up there, thankfully. Then maybe we've had some success. Yeah.
I think this is true not only for this class, but other classes. One of the value of a classroom is not the fact that facilitators, but the people in the group, the richness, the richness that the participants bring. Now, obviously, it's very impactful in this particular one presentation, but in many things.
Yeah.
Something for us all to remember, but it's not just the facilitator led that the classroom is about.
Yeah.
It's about the participants being able to teach other people as well.
Right. So if we're going to make that classroom experience be less about the presenter teaching best practices for presentation, that has to happen somewhere, right? Somehow they need to learn that. Now maybe you're going to have them just stand up there and you're going to give them lots of coaching and feedback, and they're never actually going to tell them what the best practices are for presenting or designing, what have you. Maybe that's one approach. But another approach might be to take some of that best practices kind of stuff, move it online. Let it be self-paced. Why? I mean, when you design a presentation, you're doing it on your own. You're not doing it in front of an audience. When you're actually, right? So there's not a tremendous amount of value of bringing people into a classroom to teach them how to design a presentation. There's some. You can argue for it, but if you had to give up something, that might be something where you could give up. And you say, let's teach them how to design things, and let's make some of the best practices, things that they learn on their own, and then let's bring them together, maybe online, live, to do practice.
Well, yeah. I think they have to be catch themselves doing something good. Let's assume that they're all kind of thinking they're not good at presenting.
Yeah.
But if they come together, now I'm thinking more in terms of, a lot of this goes on in the background, maybe building towards a final presentation that will incorporate all of these skills. But if they could come together for short periods of time at regular intervals where they could focus on one part of these skills, they prepare ahead of time, do it for the others, get feedback, and test the success, they might get through that barrier that you're talking about a lot faster. Because
yeah.
As they find themselves being suddenly successful or better than they thought at being recognized by this group that would be supportive, I think they would really incorporate a lot of these skills more quickly and more fluidly.
I'll
just hook right on front that I'm not a lover of e-learning. I've not really taken anything that, like, for many reasons, that appeals to me. So when I'm looking at this list of items and I'm saying, okay, what would I get benefit from? Rather than having all this stuff that we said you could put purely cognitive, you could put it in an e-learning format, I would rather have a book that would give it to me right here. Right? So I'm struggling with what would be the advantage, because it would be far more expensive, right, to do it that way than to have a great book that you say, when you come in the classroom, you're going to apply all these principles and you're going to demonstrate to us, blah, 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 blah. So I'm just sort of
That's a great setup for what I was going to say next, actually.
Okay.
Because just last year we had to train presenters overseas. And so we didn't have the benefit of being able to bring them in face-to-face for a lot of it. We did wind up doing some face-to-face, but we had to get them ready to present. And so the process is a slow, gradual one, right? They're all scared out of their minds to do this. And so one of the techniques that we use, obviously, yeah, you could put it in a book, you put it in an e-learning course. It really doesn't matter too much as long as it's well-designed information. If that's all it is, it's just information. Find the best way to design that. But what we needed to do is get them practicing, get them doing it, right, and start to get some comfort with it. So one of the neat things about webinars and web conferencing technology is the advent of the webcam. So we took advantage of the webcam. All of our learners had webcams, and when we did our webinars, we would all use the webcams, and we would use it for demonstration and so forth. But we would have them record offline using their webcams presentations, small ones, little bits at first, little tiny ones around really insignificant, fun things, and then built up little by little till they were doing much more robust, more interesting presentations. And then we started getting them actually using video cameras to do, you know, full-length ones. Now that, we didn't have this back then, but now there are webcams that follow you around. So you could actually put a webcam there and do a presentation and move around and so forth, and it would follow you. And so then they were able to send that video footage to the instructor. The instructor was then able to construct some feedback for them. And once we got them to a certain point where they were competent and could handle feedback from the rest of the audience, then that's when we started playing videos for one another. Sometimes we'd interweave those with trainer bloopers, where we'd show professional trainers and some of the silly mistakes that they made in real life, so that they could see that, you know, even professionals make silly mistakes, and, you know, try to reduce some of that. And that was all done online. And so we reduced a lot of the resistance, overcame a lot of those barriers little by little, through good design, through good facilitation. And the technology was just there to support us. And the webcam just happened to be the technology that we used. I've heard of other folks doing it where they have, and I guess this is before the webcam, where they have people videotape themselves and then upload video files to one another, or upload video files to the instructor. So that was another way of doing it. Because some of this stuff, they can do on their own. That doesn't mean there isn't value to bring them all together and doing some major presentations in front of everybody. But we built up to that, so that by the time we all met in New York and flew them all over to meet in one place to do all these presentations, they already had lots of practice. They already gotten the feedback. They already knew the best practice. They knew the things they were supposed to do and not supposed to do. They just hadn't yet done them in front of a big audience. Now they're doing them in front of a big audience, but it's all people they've been interacting with through email, through chat, and through the webinars. And so they all kind of know each other. And so they had that fun thing where you know people, but you've never met them face to face. And so they went through all that, and We did icebreakers and stuff, got them all comfortable with each other, and then they started presenting. And like you said before, the Dale Carnegie method, I guess, yeah, they were very supportive of one another and were very careful to make sure to say the good things that they saw. And I think part of it was because of the rapport. Part of it is because they're all in the same boat. And part of it is because that's what we modeled during the process as we were teaching this. So rather than bring them all together and try to do a one-week crash course on presentation skills or a three-day course, crash course, we broke up the training into little tidbits and little tiny pieces and brought them along more slowly. To us, that was a more effective way to teach this skill to people who aren't comfortable presenting than the boot camp approach, which is what we typically use, right? Bring them in, make them do 50 push-ups in the first minute, right? That can work for some things and for some audiences, but for this, it didn't work so well. And we tried that before. And does that answer your question? And what can you do with technology besides just create fancy books? Yeah, so there's opportunities out there. We're also now looking at, if we had to do this again, taking advantage of Second Life and virtual worlds. Any of you familiar with that, virtual worlds?
What's Second Life?
Second Life is a place where you can go online and create a character, a three-dimensional illustration that represents you. That's called your avatar. And your avatar can go out and interact in this virtual 3D space. And so Penn State, and I imagine LaSalle, probably has an island on Second Life, right? That's what they call the piece of property that you have in this virtual 3D world. And like Penn State has an actual campus, a replica of University Park's campus. And you can go there and you can walk around campus. You can go into classrooms and sit down in a classroom and interact with people from all over the world. And you can do it through text chat. And you can, if you have your headphones on, you can do it through voiceover IP. So we're looking at the possibility of, if we had to do this again, how might we take advantage of that? Because that gives us a bit more immediacy and more social intimacy than the webinar format, where you can only hear each other or maybe see some, you know, kind of the fuzzy webcam images of one another. So we're thinking about, you know, if we had to do this again, might we combine some of that stuff with the webcam with some experiences in a virtual world where they could interact more freely with one another, and we can send them off and have them work in groups. Because one of the neat things that you can do is, if we had this sort of a setup in this virtual world, the five of you, when you're talking to each other, you wouldn't hear them. You would hear this sort of like, kind of like you do in real life. And so based on your proximity to the person, the clarity of the audio transmission gets better. And so in that sense, you feel like you're in a room full of people meeting in groups, but you can hear one another more clearly than you can everybody else. You can't do that in a webinar. You can't split people up and send them to different parts of the room and have them interact and do group activities. With virtual worlds, you can. So you can do some of the things that you might have otherwise done in the classroom, but can't in a webinar, and you can begin to do some of those there. Again, it doesn't necessarily replace the classroom experience, but it's not a bad surrogate when you can't do the classroom experience, when it's just physically not possible, financially not possible. Conferences, I imagine all of you have gone to a conference before. I have a hard time getting to conferences. It's you know, for me to take 2, 3, 4 days out of my week and spend it, you know, in some location away from my clients and my staff and stuff, it's very hard. And a lot of people are experiencing that. And then travel budgets cut and so forth, and conference budgets cut. So what a lot of organizations are doing now is setting up virtual conferences through virtual worlds. And there are companies now that have set up three-dimensional virtual spaces where you can rent and you can have meeting facilitators help you, and they could come in. You could say, I want a room for 500 people, and I want it set up with round tables of 10 people each, and they click a few buttons, and boom, you get your round tables. And there's a little reception area with shrimps and ice statues and stuff. I know that I don't think you can actually eat any of it, but it's there for decor, and so people can hang out and just talk to each other during the breaks. Right? And so you can do some of the things that you could, to replicate what you could in real life. But that's not the cool thing. The cool thing is that you've got a three-dimensional world that you can manipulate, that the learners can manipulate. So now that creates all sorts of opportunities. So if I want to, in the middle of our classroom, drop a Huey in the middle of it and begin to dissect it, so be able to teach you how to, you know, the different parts of a helicopter, I could do that. Where else could I possibly do that? Where we could actually take a physical tour through blood vessels, where we could, do all sorts of stuff like that. I mean, it's just neat, the potential of what down the road, and not the distant future, what the things that we'll be able to do in that three-dimensional environment are. So that's something to think about. All right. Well, we don't have time to, because are we over? A little bit over? Okay. Yeah, so we don't have time to get into some of the other things. But I think we did talk about, how can we optimize for promoting transfer? How can we optimize to try to gain commitment? How can we keep it cohesive and give it legs? We talked about some of these things. It's a complicated thing because there are so many technologies and so many approaches. But I hopefully the thing that you walk away with is this idea of trying to keep an open mind that, yes, we've all seen really bad e-learning, and we've all sat through really bad classroom programs. Hopefully this was not one of them. But there's tremendous potential if we apply good design, that the technologies are getting to the point where we can do some really cool things, and you can take advantage of the strengths of one technology and match them up against the weaknesses of another, and you can get a much better approach than if you had just gone with the one technology that's not that good, right? The classroom experience, as much as we always are using it for comparison, is good, but we've all been to bad classroom training. and there are downsides to being in the classroom. There are things that you can't do effectively in the classroom that you could do in other contexts and that you could do online. And so it's a matter of balancing out. What are the strengths? What do we do really well in the classroom? What can we potentially do really well in the classroom if we design it right? And what could we potentially do really well online if we designed it right? And what could we potentially do really well offline, right? If there are things that we can do through mobile learning, for example, to push the training out into the workplace through knowledge management systems and so forth, that we can get people doing more of the learning on the job, right? And less of it being offline, online or in the classroom, but more of it happening offline in the work, technologies can help us with that, but it all comes back to really good design. Anyway, thank you so much for coming out tonight. If any of you have any additional questions, other things, philosophical issues you want to talk about, I'm here. Thank you.